What's up, everybody? It's your boy George Carmen. You're listening to Command the Mic Pod, brought to you by Full Press Coverage. Let's get it on. What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Command the Mic podcast. I'm here with George Carmi. Thank you for spending your Tuesday afternoon with us. I'm here joined by Deuce from Red Zone in the Lab as my co-host today. How are you doing today, Deuce?
Good. How you guys doing?
Well, good, man. Good. Happy to have you here, man. So I'm also here by Mark Bullock, formerly of The Athletic and The Washington Post. He has a great Substack articles that he posts up every single week in regard to all breakdowns. How are you doing today, Mark?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Of course, man. No problem. So, guys, gentlemen, we're at the part of the offseason where basically we're looking into the Commanders, looking to kind of build the team. You know, things are kind of in flux without an owner right now. We have an owner, I guess, kind of in limbo, but we're also kind of looking at big picture things in regard to building the team and moving forward. What I liked about bringing Mark on today is I know Mark kind of has an offensive lens and kind of looks at basically the team from more of an offensive and scheme perspective. And what I wanted to get from today's podcast was basically what his thoughts were on an offensive coordinator. So today, guys, we're going to kind of dive into that. It's going to be the frame of our conversation. But what I want to start off with before we'll start off with Mark, I guess, right here. Mark, last year, many people kind of think that the Commanders maybe underachieved on offense. Maybe Scott Turner didn't necessarily maximize the talent on the team. Is that something that you necessarily agree with, or how do you feel about that? Like, you know, what's your opinion on the team from last year?
Yeah, I think it's hard to say he maximized the talent because they had a lot of talent and the offense wasn't very good in terms of scoring points and okay. Things like that. So the production didn't necessarily match what the talent level that they have. But I don't necessarily think that was all on him. Like, obviously the quarterback play is pretty significant part of that. And you know, they had Carson Wentz, and then they went to Heineke, and then they went back to Wentz, and then Heineke, and then Howell. And so there was a lot of turnover at that position. And that doesn't generally lend to teams being overly successful on offense. And then, of course, they had issues up front with the offensive line. And so it was a little bit tough. And I think the overall identity of the offense, I think, was there was a bit of a clash between what Scott Turner kind of how he envisions playing offense and how Ron Rivera kind of wants the team to be. Rivera's this old school defensive minded head coach. And those guys tend to be kind of, we want to run the ball. We want to control time of possession. We want to, dominate and on first and second down and get into third and shorts and make it easy for the quarterback that way. Whereas the kind of younger offensive minds tend to think, well, we want to pass the ball a little bit more and we can get the quarterback into a rhythm with certain looks and certain throws and create some more explosive plays and that can lend to a better offense overall. And so. I think there was a bit of a culture clash between Scott Turner and Rivera in that perspective. So it kind of led to this disjointed offense where Turner was kind of calling the run plays and stuff that Rivera would want, but it didn't marry up with the kind of passing plays and stuff that he wanted to call. So it kind of felt like there was almost two separate offenses being run at the same time. And they didn't mesh very well together. So that was kind of the underlying issue for me.
Gotcha. Deuce, feel free to jump in whenever you want. Deuce, I don't know if you want to ask a question now, if you want me to do one.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about the season, you kind of mentioned Ron Rivera. It was a time during the season when Ron Rivera openly admitted that he had a talk with Scott Turner about running the ball. And that was like before the Eagles game. And my whole thought after that game was, everyone is excited about that win but Scott Turner. Is how much we actually ran the ball. Do you think that was that mess with Scott Turner's psyche as he went along the rest of the year?
I don't know if it necessarily messed with his psyche. The weird thing is that Scott Turner actually designed some really good run plays. Like you saw in that Eagles game, they were pretty effective. And when they ran the ball, they were pretty effective most of the season running the ball. And he deserves credit for they had a pretty dramatic shift from last year when they ran the ball successfully in that four-game win streak last year. They were primarily a zone-based team with Antonio Gibson. And then this year they had Brian Robinson, who suits more gap scheme stuff, and they're doing a lot more gap scheme plays with counters and power schemes and duo and the tight ends moving all over the place and that kind of stuff. And they still had success despite, you know, they were having turnover on the offensive line. They were changing from being a zone team to a power team or a gap team and changing the running back. So it's kind of odd that he's actually quite good at designing a running offense. He just didn't match up with what he wants to do passing wise. I think the clash was that Scott Turner likes to spread out a defense and generate one-on-one matchups and kind of, you know, if he goes to an empty set, he gets Terry McLaurin in the slot and matched up on a linebacker. And then that's the kind of thing that Scott McLaurin loves.
Scott McLaurin.
Scott Turner likes to do. That's basically what his offense is about, is generating those mismatches. Whereas when Rivera was kind of like, we're going to run the ball and that is our primary option on first down and second down and sometimes on third down, then that kind of, he adapted to that by going with those, you know, heavy sets with two tight ends and running those gap scheme stuff with Brian Robinson. But he didn't have the passing game to build off of that. He didn't build into a play action game. His passing concepts didn't mesh well with that style of play. So I think it was just the disconnect between the two coaches that caused that.
Yeah, we've heard some things about Scott Turner, why he wasn't successful. And, you know, a lot of the criticism was sequential, right? He couldn't call plays in sequence. He couldn't game plan four or five plays ahead of time. And we also talked about that mismatch of offense and passing and run game. Do you think Scott Turner has an upside and upper potential like around the league, or do you think he was kind of limited here with Ron Rivera? Like, what's your overall impressions now that he's gone?
I think he has potential to become a good offensive coordinator in the league. And like this time last year, we were talking about like if he can turn around Carson Wentz, he's going to be in for head coaching jobs. So, 100%. If he had, given how Carson Wentz played this year, he definitely would be a head coach right now. But there is some upside. I think he just philosophically he's different from the kind of the guys that we've seen in Washington here for a while, like Kyle Shanahan and Sean McVay. Those two guys were really good at what you mentioned, sequential play calling. They'd have their run schemes, they'd build off of the zone scheme, but the play action would look exactly the same as the run concept. And then they'd build they'd make little adjustments in the play action concepts where instead of a receiver breaking inside, he suddenly breaks outside. And then the defense, it all looks the same to the defense at the snap of the ball. And that makes it really hard for them to defend. Whereas Scott Turner philosophically is almost the opposite, where he wants to confuse a defense by showing them a million different looks, using hundreds of formations, motions, personnel groups, but that's all just window dressing to disguise the kind of handful of concepts that he really likes. So you saw him running like mesh every third and short. We always saw some form of mesh concept on third and short, but it was always disguised with sometimes they were in a 2x2 look, sometimes a 3x1, and there'd be tons of motion. Sometimes they'd be empty and all this kind of stuff. And so that was kind of his philosophy, was he'll keep it easier on quarterbacks by the read is always going to be the same because it's going to be the same handful of concepts that he's going to use every game, but it's just going to be how they get to that concept is going to be a little bit different, and that'll disguise it to stop the defense from knowing exactly what's happening. So I think there's merit to that kind of philosophy, but it's just I think he needs a little bit of maybe a more experienced member on the staff to kind of help him make sure that he marries up that run and that pass scheme to and build into a play action attack. He didn't really use play action that well. So I think if he can kind of marry the passing game and the run game a little bit, and part of that might be, again, because Rivera kind of demanded a certain style of run offense and Scott Turner kind of prefers to be more, you know, shotgun, spread out the defense and inside zone handoffs off and with some RPOs and all that kind of stuff. So, I think he has potential to be a successful coordinator in the league. I don't think he would have got hired very quickly by, you know, Josh McDaniels if he didn't. I just think it didn't work for him here because of probably the quarterback situation and you know, the style of play that Ron Rivera wanted.
Do you think it's more of an issue with him being able to put those plays together, how you say, kind of marry those different, the run and the pass, and know when to kind of like set up the play action? How much of that do you think is just him getting a grasp on that? And actually, or do you think it's more so him teaching his players on how to actually run those different concepts and Heineke and the skill position players? Because that's something that we kind of heard like the week that he got fired when we was hearing all types of stuff, is that he's not a good teacher. Can you kind of see that from the plays that's being run, or is that something you need to be in the building to see?
I think that's kind of more something you need to be in the building for. And I think you have to kind of take those kind of comments with a bit of pinch of salt, because, you know, everyone kind of gets bad mouth when they get fired, right? And everyone in the building is kind of shedding blame, being like, oh no, that was all Scott Turner's fault. That wasn't anything to do with us. We were fine. It was Turner's fault. And so I'm sure there was some of that where, you know, some players maybe legitimately thought that he wasn't a good teacher, or he didn't reach out to them the way that and connect with them the way that they might have liked or wanted. But I think we saw enough potential in the offense, and like at the start of the season, they had a bunch of explosive plays. They started those first two games with a ton of explosive plays, and nobody was complaining then. So I tend to kind of not buy into that too much. I think it's probably more just a case of, you know, they had some pretty shaky quarterback play here. He never really got to have a settled starting quarterback for other than like Taylor Heineke. Yeah. Exactly. For the whole time he was kind of switching quarterback, and they were switching it. They had a new center every other week, and sometimes it was a new right guard or a right tackle or what have you. So I think he handled kind of a tough situation and still made the offense kind of okay. It wasn't great, but when you step back and you think of the situation he was in, like how much can you expect out of that kind of situation with the quarterback play and the offensive line issues that they had? So I don't think he was terrible. I don't necessarily think he was the most amazing offensive coordinator in the league either, but it seemed like it was time to move on given how those comments came out, and certainly before the final game of the year where that was that Washington Post report where, you know, it was like nine players. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that kind of talk bad about him and what have you. At that point, you kind of know he's lost the locker room and you have to move on. But I think he has a future in the NFL.
I agree with that. I can see Scott Turner having some potential there. So there was a lot of, like, you know, conversations, a lot of talk about Rivera's postseason conference, right? He had that famous quote saying, hey, that 2-to-1 ratio. I know Deuce loves the 2-to-1 ratio. The whole 2-to-1 ratio of run to pass. I don't particularly buy it. I don't think he's necessarily going to go that run heavy in regard to that. But I was just kind of curious because, Mark, I know you're an X and O's kind of guy. Does that suit our personnel, in your opinion? Or do you think, if you were the head coach, or if you were the offensive coordinator, would you go a different direction? Like, how do you feel about where does our offensive, like, system skill set sit in regard to play calling and scheme? What do you think about all that?
Yeah, well, nobody goes 2-for-1 in the modern NFL. It just of course, doesn't happen. I don't think it has happened since like 2003 or something like that.
The Steelers or something, right? I heard like a long time ago. Yeah,
so okay. it doesn't happen. I think that kind of quote is somewhat taken out of context.
I agree.
But, you know, it was an easy target. They didn't necessarily clarify it the best they should have. So, mm-hmm. The run first approach isn't necessarily the worst idea, because as Rivera has pointed out, quite a few of the teams that go deep into the playoffs consistently are run first teams. Like the 49ers are predominantly a run first team.
Yeah.
The Rams, when they won the Super Bowl, they were a run first team.
Eagles to an extent.
Eagles certainly, you would say they are a run first team. The difference about those teams is that they are running to set up stuff. They're running to set up the play action. They're running to not just to run the ball and, you know, run the ball first down, run the ball second down, and then if they're in third and short, they might run the ball again. They run the ball more often than they pass, but they are still incorporating a lot of passing concepts. They're still using passing plays on first down. They're using play action. So they're not that 2-to-1 run offense. Nobody is. For Washington, I think they can follow that kind of blueprint of, you know, what the Eagles have done recently with Jalen Hurts and what the 49ers do and what McVay and the Rams do. They can follow that blueprint of being a run first team. But you have to run with a purpose of, you know, we're showing this look to get to this look, and we're setting up this by we're faking this outside zone to get to a bootleg, and when we're running this inside zone to get to an RPO later in the game, and that kind of thing. So you can still see teams that are run first still have, you know, the thing that a lot of fans I've seen talking about is that Washington has three really good receivers, and if they're going to go run first, then what's the point of taking Jahan Dotson in the first round last year? Those guys, there's some truth to that, but at the same time, like, you see guys are productive every year in run first offenses, and there's plenty of receiving yards to be had, like George Kittle and Debo Samuel and those kind of guys pick up tons of yards, and even the fullback called Juszczyk in with San Fran, like, he gets plenty of receiving yards every year.
He does.
It's not like the receivers can't be productive in a run first offense. So I think they can go down that path, but you want to, if you do want to run the ball first and foremost, it's running it with a purpose to set up things later in the game. And I think that is a perfectly reasonable kind of balance to try to strike.
Yeah, because we know Mayhew made the comment, right? And Ron was like right beside him. So it wasn't like Ron could say, nah, man, that's not what we talked about. Like, he can't do that right when, and that was like the worst thing Mayhew could have said. But when we talk about being run first, are you a component of like the screen game, which we were horrible at? You can say it's play call, you can say it's offensive line play, whatever. But how do you look at those things like the quick screens, the slants being extensions of the running game? Do you kind of count that also towards like a run first offense?
Absolutely. Yeah. And most offensive coordinators and offensive coaches in the league will tell you that that's exactly what they consider. You know, if they build an RPO play where it's a cold run, but they have the option to throw a bubble screen if the look is right, or they throw a slant if the look is right, or whatever it is, then, you know, that's an extension of the run game, because like an RPO is still a cold run play, but it just has the option to pass if the look is right. And that's how, like, the Chiefs, from watching a lot of Eric Bieniemy recently, the things that you notice about the Chiefs offense is they're not a run first team, but they still are effective running the ball because they do those kind of quick screens and the quick game passing concepts, and they build it a lot of RPOs. And like the first thing that stood out to me was in every game that I watched, every RPO that they called gave them an advantage in some way. They were never running a play into a bad look. It was never like, oh, we're handing the ball off and they've got a loaded front and we can't get anything out of that. It was always, well, the RPO we have packaged in with a bubble screen one side, either they're bringing a linebacker out to cover that bubble screen, in which case we've got a lighter box to run into, or they're keeping the box heavy and we've got an easy bubble screen to throw to the outside for a quick 5 or 6 yards. So that kind of thoughtful design, and it's not just a designing of a play, it's knowing what the tendencies of the defense are, what they like to, how they like to cover up certain looks and formations, and what downs and distances they like to play certain coverages and certain, obviously, blitz packages and certain fronts and that kind of thing, and how you can exploit that with different schemes. So, and that's something that the Chiefs do extremely well, and something that I think was probably lacking here in Washington is sometimes they didn't quite run into the most optimal looks, and I think the best teams find ways to scheme up the most optimal looks.
And that's a good little pivot point, right? Because I think for one, Washington does have, in my opinion, a quarterback that could potentially run the RPO, right? And I just love that whole chess match aspect of the whole NFL, like, you know, scheming things and moving things around. So my question to you is this, right? I don't know how much you've dove into Sam Howell and whether he is that guy in your opinion. That's kind of what I'm looking at, right? Like, right now, he's technically the only quarterback on the roster. I know Deuce's boy Jake Fromm's deep there on the bench. He's potentially under contract as well. But, you know, there was talk. You know, I brought up a little conversation piece yesterday. Should Washington draft a quarterback? Should they have their eyes open on a veteran and things of that nature? And, you know, I respect your opinion, Mark. How do you feel? Are you confident in Sam Howell? Do you think he could potentially build around him? Would you go a different direction in the draft or a veteran? You know, I guess I'll start off with the first part. Like, how confident are you in Sam Howell, and what have you seen in him that builds your confidence?
Yeah, I think he's shown that he has a fair bit of potential, and there's some raw tools there that, you know, you can look to as that's something that we can build on, and that's something that we can get productive play out of. Like, obviously, the arm jumps off the screen whenever I watch him, and you know, the ability to drive the ball all the way down the field or all over the fields is obviously a very attractive option to have. But, you know, that arm can be useless if they're not doing other things right. And I think that was the thing that concerned me in preseason when everyone was saying that we need to start him early in the year, was his footwork didn't match up with what he was doing with his eyes and his reads. His footwork didn't match up, and he was quite often taking the wrong number of drops and steps on his drop, or the, like, too many hitches up into the pocket, and he just wasn't in sync with the routes that he was reading. And he still played relatively well in preseason. Like, his preseason wasn't bad by any stretch of the imagination, but it was kind of the little details that the quarterback needs to kind of survive the fundamentals in the NFL. They weren't there, and that's why he needed the time that he did need to kind of get that. And we saw significant improvements of that in that final game. And granted, it was just one game, but almost immediately that first pass that he threw, you could see how his first read was the flat, and he took his quick drop and he had his body positioned looking at the flat, ready to throw there. And then when it wasn't there, he took a step up in the pocket, repositioned his feet, got himself aligned with his next target, which was McLaurin on the crosser, and he hit that for the touchdown. And he did that a couple of times throughout the game. So he never did anything like exceptional in terms of like progressing through five different reads or, you know, diagnosing an amazing disguise coverage and finding the exact hole in that coverage. Like, it wasn't Tom Brady back there, but it was a marked improvement from what he was at in preseason, and enough for me to say there was good progress. There was signs that, you know, he can keep taking steps forward. And for at this point in the offseason, it's tough because the outlook for the best outlook for the team isn't necessarily the best outlook for the head coach right now.
It's a very weird dynamic right now, 100%.
So yeah. For the sake of the team, the outlook of, you know, playing Sam Howell this year, and either he looks all right and you see that you have a guy that you can develop and grow with, then great. And if he doesn't, then you're probably getting a high draft pick and you're clearing out the front office and the coaching staff, and you're getting an entire new regime in, and they're going to bring their own quarterback in anyway. So for me, that makes a lot of sense in terms of an organization direction, but from Ron Rivera's perspective, that probably doesn't make as much sense, because, you know, if there's a new owner coming in, which it seems like there will be, he's going to be under pressure to win, and, you know, he's experienced this all before, and he knows that if he doesn't win and take them to the playoffs and go deep into the playoffs, then a new owner is probably going to want his own guy. So it's tough from his perspective. And it sounds like he, you know, the report of they're telling offensive coordinators they'd like to give Sam Howell a shot. It sounds like he's still thinking the long-term interests of the organization rather than his own personal best interests, which is, you know, good for the organization and very classy of Rivera. Yeah, I think Sam Howell, to the short answer to the question, which has gone on too long now, but I think he has a lot of potential, and he does he showed significant improvement from what he did in preseason in terms of like his fundamentals, like his footwork and reading the defense and that kind of thing. I think there was a lot of potential there that looked markedly improved from preseason to that final game. And if he can continue that development. I think there's enough there where you can build an offense around his skill set to at least be somewhat successful next year.
How important is Sam Howell when it comes to the offensive coordinator search? Because you kind of mentioned that, you know, there was rumor that, you know, Ron Rivera's telling, you know, coordinators during the interviews that, hey, look, Sam Howell is my guy. Does that kind of like cut the interview pool in half when you bringing in guys that could work with a young quarterback that you may end up not even being here next year? But that's a whole different discussion for the coordinators. How important do you think who they bring in is going to, you know, improve or get the best out of Sam Howell, as you said?
Yeah, it might cut down the candidates a little bit, but I think having thought more about that, my initial thought was, yeah, it's going to cut down the candidates because not everyone's going to love Sam Howell. And I've, obviously, as he dropped to the fifth round last year, not every team did love him. So not every offensive coordinator in the league that or offensive coordinator candidate that they could hire is going to love him. But that doesn't mean that they're going to be put off from a job if it's a promotion for them or an opportunity for them. And maybe if they did like him, then they see this as, you know, maybe if I win with Sam Howell and have him productive and Rivera still gets fired, I'm first in line for the next job. So they could see it as a quick ladder to promotion to head coach. So that's the other side of it. But yeah, the you know, coordinators are going to want their quarterback. We do see guys hired all the time to kind of come in and fix their guy. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. Like, you know, Jay Gruden was hired with the intention of him fixing RG3. And, you know, a year later it was Kirk Cousins, you know, gig and RG3 was out the door. So it's a tough one. But I think, if they wanted to attract the top candidates, which it would be tough for them to do anyway, given the ownership situation. But if they wanted to do that, then they'd probably have to be going like, okay, we're going to go all out for Derek Carr, or we're going to go make a big trade for Aaron Rodgers or Lamar Jackson or whatever. They're going to go get one of the big name veterans. But they're not targeting those guys for other reasons. So I think they can justify being, and they've targeted more running backs, coaches and stuff like that. So if they can convince those guys, hey, Brian Robinson's really good, Antonio Gibson's really good, we're going to invest resources in the offensive line, and we're going to build that up real strong. And we think Sam Howell, for a year, because of his running ability, his mobility, we can incorporate that into the run game. We can use RPOs. We can build a play-action attack off of that. You look at the blueprint, what the Eagles did with Jalen Hurts. They they had an extremely strong offensive line. They could run the ball just down anyone's throat because that offensive line was so good. But when you add in the threat of a quarterback that can also run, and then the RPO game, and then the play action game, that kind of builds an offense where you're limiting the amount of times a quarterback has to actually drop back and pass. So if you can find a coordinator that can see that kind of vision, and you say, this is what we're going to do with the offensive line. We're going to spend a first round pick. We're going to go and sign a top free agent. We're going to completely revamp this offensive line. We love our skill position guys, and we think Sam Howell can develop enough and we can insulate him with being part of the run game, doing the RPOs, the play action stuff. Then I think there is a kind of recipe for success there. It's just finding the guy that will kind of tap into that, I guess.
That's a great pivot point. Thank you, Mr. Mark Bullock. I like that. So Mark's actually doing an excellent job on his Substack, kind of going through the offensive coordinators and their strengths and weaknesses. And that's kind of, you know, the main reason why I have him on here today, because I want to hear his perspective on things. Sam Howell is definitely going to be an intriguing character as a quarterback. You know, what I've been hearing recently is the Commanders kind of view him as like a Heinicke plus, which I don't know how I feel about that. Right? He's like an elevated Taylor Heinicke. So we'll see. He has a better arm, a little bit more mobile, a little more stout. But we'll see how that goes. So I'm curious, like, I've actually read your articles except for the Benmi one. I started reading it, but I fell asleep last night. But it wasn't your fault. It was late night reading. I should have said it. It was like midnight. He put it out late. We have London time, so it was out late last night. But basically, so various offensive coordinators. I think he had Shermer already. I think he might have did London as well. I'm not sure if he did London yet.
I hadn't done London Benmi yet.
Okay, no, so you have a couple of them coming up. And actually, Shermer,
he's with the Titans now.
Yeah, exactly. I saw that
with the Titans. Yeah.
So my, you know, I don't want to leave the witness. I'm kind of curious, put it out there. So from all of those offensive coordinators you've been evaluating in their schemes, which one do you like the best so far? What do you like?
It's tough to say because a lot of them, you don't know exactly how involved they are in their current
That's true.
The only one that they've interviewed that, you know, has called plays and run an offense of their own before would be Pat Shurmur. So you have an idea of the kind of offense he would want to run. You have an idea what the other guys would want to do based on the systems they've been in. And like, obviously they've interviewed Eric Studsville, or is it Studsville or
Studsville, I believe. Studsville. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They interviewed him from Miami, and Miami has Mike McDaniels, which is a branch of that Kyle Shanahan and Mike Shanahan tree. And Studsville was with Gary Kubiak in Denver when they won their Super Bowl, and that's another branch of that Shanahan tree. So you imagine he would be the kind of another branch of the Shanahan tree, which is a system that I absolutely love. So
zone run scheme?
Yeah, zone run scheme and the play action stuff off of that. And that stuff would appeal to me personally.
Yeah, sure.
But you don't know, obviously, to what extent. Like, he's not called plays for, as far as I'm aware, he's not called plays for those guys. If he has called plays, it's on a limited basis. And so you don't know how his feel for the game is and how well he does what we talked about earlier, that kind of sequential play calling mm-hmm. where you're showing certain looks to set up things for later in the game. And that's what makes Kyle Shanahan so good, and that's what makes Sean McVay and Andy Reid, that makes those elite play callers so good. So, and without seeing them call plays, you don't know whether they can do it. So it's tough with guys like that. I think they all have their upside, and I, as I said, I kind of would lean more towards that Shanahan system because that's a system that I know and learned a lot of football from. So I guess
it's tried and true. It's been proven over the years as well.
I guess Studsville or Studsville would be the guy that I'd be leaning more towards, but that wouldn't necessarily mean that I think anyone else would necessarily do a bad job or an amazing job. I think there's Eric Bieniemy, after watching what the Chiefs do, you know, you don't really know exactly what's going on inside that building. And you hear a lot of things about, it's mainly Andy Reid calling the plays and running the offense, and the enemy normally takes a kind of a back seat. And then you hear sometimes, you know, actually he plays and he has a bigger print on the offense than people think. And so it's hard to determine exactly how much of that Chiefs offense would translate. And part of that Chiefs offense being so good is that Patrick Mahomes and Travis Kelce are really
pretty good players, I think, right?
Yeah. they allow you to do a
little
lot
better
of
than Howard, a little bit.
Yeah, those guys have a connection that allows them to get away with some. If they make a mistake with a play call or what have you, then those guys can kind of get them out of trouble. But the thing that stood out, I think I mentioned earlier, with that Chiefs offense was they very rarely run something into a bad look, and the RPOs were the example I used, and
it was beautiful. It was great.
Yeah. So, but it stood out with, you know, passing concepts. They were very aware of, this defense tends to run a quarters look in this situation, or this defense tends to run cover three, or this defense runs man in certain situations. And they'd have a play call for that. And their play calls would have answers if, like backup options, if they didn't get the look they were expecting. But more often than not, they would get the look they were expecting, and they'd be able to go to the kind of the primary options on that play. So that was that. If Bieniemy could kind of, he wouldn't be able to replicate what Mahomes and Kelce have got, obviously. But if he could replicate the structure that they have in Kansas City, where they're consistently calling plays into good looks to give the players the best chance of success on a down-to-down basis, then that's ultimately going to produce a better offense. So, but we just don't know to what extent Bieniemy is involved there. So it's hard to say whether he'd be able to replicate that or not.
It is tough. And one thing, I know Duke's going to jump in on a question, but one thing, I know all of us kind of listen to Logan Paul, so we respect his ability and his acumen for football as well. One thing that I kind of learned from him was, Just that whole offensive lens, that teaching aspect, right? So I was listening to Logan Paulson one time. He was telling me about Kyle Shanahan and how overly prepared he would have his offense going, right? He'd say, you know, before the game, you know, he'd emphasize things and he would give them alternate looks, as you kind of alluded to, Mark. Like, hey, you know, this is option one. If you come up here, cover four, it's what you do. It's what you do for cover three, what you do for cover two. They were overly prepared for any play, so they were highly confident walking into the game. I think that's where we're kind of at a deficit right now in D.C. We have a defensive-minded coach. So coming in, we're kind of like trying to adjust on the fly in in-game situations, and it might not necessarily feel very comfortable there. So I think that good teaching aspect, as Deuce, you kind of talked about before, like having a strong teacher, that would be huge. So it is kind of interesting. I wonder, I like the upside of Benemy, but I wonder if he's the teacher that we are hoping for. And I guess none of us know that right now. So I don't know, Deuce, what were you going to say? So sorry to interrupt you.
No. And that's like when we talk about the offensive coordinator search, Mark, and, you know, Ron took a flyer on a rookie OC, right? And Scott Turner. Obviously, it didn't work out. Would Ron want to do that again? Well, essentially, his job may be on the line, right? So when I think about Bieniemy, I was kind of talking to someone earlier that's, you know, pretty plugged in with the Chiefs. And one thing that he said was Eric Bieniemy was similar to Dan Campbell as far as his competitiveness and how he approaches the game with his players. And that's something I've never heard. And this is, you know, this is something I've never heard about BM because, you know, I mean, I'm not going to sit up and act like I watch all the Chiefs games. Right. But when we do see him and certain things that we hear about him, but he wants to get the best out of his players, even the best out of his best players, to the point where it's not like a, you know, you're just like, you are doing this, but you can do this better by doing this, and this. How important do you think that is, and also like a rookie coordinator that really doesn't, or like a running backs coach coming into this position that doesn't have that experience in being hands-on with players like that?
Yeah, it's definitely like being able to teach your offense and having your players understand not just what their assignments are, but understand the bigger picture and why they're doing what they're doing. I think getting that level of understanding in the system automatically kind of gets players to buy in more, because if the kind of old-fashioned way was it's my way or the highway and you just do what I'm telling you to do, I think modern players and younger people in general tend to they want to understand
with that money of production 100% I agree.
they want to know why and they want to understand why, and I think that's a good thing, because when you understand why, you can understand the bigger picture, and understanding the bigger picture makes just everything click a little bit better. And on the defensive side of the ball, it's easier to kind of explain, like a safety like Cam Curl, he understands the bigger picture of the defense. And so he knows when he can cheat from his responsibility to go help someone else out. And you can kind of get that happening on like the offensive line as well, where a guard might be meant to slide one way, but if he sees like his tackle on the outside needs a hand, he can, and he doesn't have a responsibility on that side, there's no blitzer or whatever, he can kind of slide over and help out. And understanding the bigger picture and understanding the why of what you're doing in, and not just what you're doing, but what the offense is doing, I think helps everyone kind of understand the whole system better. And so for me, that would be a primary kind of objective for an offensive coordinator when you're coming in. And I think that's what separates like a guy like Kyle Shanahan apart. And I think you touched on it earlier with Logan Paulson, where he was saying that Kyle Shanahan installs that offense. And I've heard stories before where Shanahan gets halfway through a training camp and he restarts the install. So he goes back to what is day one install and
that's great.
Reinforces that those kind of days of installing the playbook and make sure everyone understands exactly why they're running, what they're running. And then if they get an injury, if someone goes down or someone's unavailable, whatever, someone else is ready to step up and fill in that spot and know exactly what their role is and where they can help out. So, I think that is incredibly important, being able to communicate your message of what you're wanting to do, but not just what you're wanting to do, why you wanted to do it, I think is huge.
So it's funny, me and Deuce were actually in a large group chat. We basically had this little conversation today is who do we want as our offensive coordinator and who do you think we're actually going to get? So I'm going to pose that quick question to you, Mark. Who do you, so Stoudsville is who you want, is I guess your number one option is what you kind of were alluding to, right?
Yeah, I guess, right? There's not a standout candidate because of the situation that they're in. So
got you.
I don't think I have necessarily a huge preference either way. If I had to pick one, just because of his familiarity with that Shanahan system, that appeals to me personally most, but you could easily sell me on someone else. I think all of them have enough questions where I go, there's reasons to like this guy and there's reasons to not like this guy. So it's not like there's a Sean McVay or a Kyle Shanahan somewhere that I'm going, go get that guy, go get that.
There's a reason why they're available right now. That's exactly right. There's definitely some questions going on, 100%.
Sure.
So the million-dollar question is, that's who you want. Who do you think we're going to end up with? So people are saying Zampezi in our group chat. I don't know how I feel about that. How do you feel?
I would not. Ken Zampezi would be the most uninspired choice.
I agree. 100% agree. Okay.
They've talked about. And, you know, he took over for Jay Gruden with that Bengals offense and basically did nothing with it. And so that would be
uninspired. I agree with you. Yeah.
Uninspired. I would not want that one. I think it sounds like they're waiting for Bieniemy and the Titans hiring a guy today. Takes them off the list. And the Ravens have had quite a few different guys in for second interviews already. So it seems like the kind of options for Bieniemy is limited. So it seems like that might be the kind of route they're going for, which I'd be fine with. I guess that's kind of that one probably has the highest upside because of what the Chiefs offense is right now. But I think it also comes with the biggest risk because you just don't know how much Bieniemy is involved in that. So I would, if I had to guess where I think it's going to go, I think it's going to go that way.
Okay, good. That's my number one choice. I wouldn't mind having Bieniemy as well. So two more questions, guys, and we can wrap it up for the day. So talked about OCs, another big hot topic of conversation is the offseason and free agents, right? And I know you definitely scheme up the defense. So these are two players that are in terms of long-term perspective, long-term construction of our roster. What are your thoughts on Daron Payne and Cam Curl? Do you think they are priority signings, and would you sign them to be back here in D.C., Mark? How do you feel about that?
Well, I wrote a piece at the end of the season saying I would sign why Daron Payne should be there, signed for to an extension, and he's. I've always maintained that he's not on the same level as Jonathan Allen. Jonathan Allen, for me, is one of the top three or four defensive tackles in the league, and it's Aaron Donald. And then it's kind of a group of Chris Jones, Jonathan Allen, and Quinnen Williams is kind of there or thereabouts as well. So that's kind of the tier one list of tackles. And then after that, Daron Payne's kind of in that second, third tier. And he's taking this kind of steps that Jonathan Allen did, where Jonathan Allen had a better fourth year than Daron Payne did, but Payne's taking that step forward. And this is his fifth year. He took another step forward and he's following that kind of progression path, just kind of at a slightly lower level than Allen. So he's a very good player, and I would keep him around. I think the interior of that defensive line has kind of been what this whole defense has been built on. And
I agree.
And those two players are very good. They obviously know each other very well and
work off each other.
I still kind of get the sense, and this is just a personal thing, but I still kind of get a sense that they don't necessarily like each other that much. But teammates don't have to like each other. They know each other's games and then they work well off of each other. So, and maybe I'm reading into things and maybe they're fine with each other. So, I would definitely sign Daron Payne if it was up to me. And I know the next guy you're going to go to is Cam Curl, and if that was an option to be able to sign both of them long-term and you're able to do that, I would also do Cam Curl because I think Cam Curl is someone that has the potential to be in the similar bracket of safeties that Jonathan Allen is with defensive tackles. And I don't think he's there yet, but I think what he can do on that defense, the amount of different roles he fills on that defense, you just see the difference when he's not there. You don't necessarily... It's not obvious to on the broadcast angle when he's playing, like how many different roles he's filling. But when he's not there, you see when he's not there, the defense doesn't stop teams. The teams score points against them.
You could argue Derek Forrest's ascension has come because Cam Curl's assisted him and kind of put him in the right position. So I can definitely see that for sure.
He fills so many roles. One play he's playing strong safety. One play he's playing in the slot. One play he's almost a linebacker. He can play part of two deep. You can occasionally have him single high. He can roll down into the box. As I said already, he can roll over the slot. He can blitz. He can cover. He can defend the run. He does so many different roles. And even if he was just to sit at strong safety, he'd be one hell of a strong safety. But the versatility that he brings to the defense, and as I mentioned earlier, his understanding of the whole picture, how he helps out so many different spots where he doesn't necessarily get the ball thrown at him and make interceptions. And that was a criticism I heard of him earlier this offseason. Like, for a safety that you're going to pay a hell of a lot of money to, he doesn't create many turnovers, but that's because the ball's not going his way because he's covering his guy, and quarterbacks don't throw to receivers that are covered. They throw to guys that they think are open. So if he is taking away so many options and funneling the ball elsewhere, he's creating opportunities for other guys. So he is a very essential part of this defense. And I would get him locked up if that's a thing that is possible this offseason.
That's kind of my argument for a CB1. I know we're going to talk about the draft in our next question, but that's my argument for a CB1. If you truly have a lockdown corner, the quarterback has to, you know, make a decision, right? Where am I going to throw the ball? Where am I going to distribute the ball? So if you truly have a CB1 and, you know, Benjamin Sanjuice is a 1B or whatever we have over there, I think the production with Cam Curl may potentially go up with forced fumbles and interceptions there because they have to throw the ball around. So I do think it'll be pretty creative altogether. I have a question that might get you in trouble, Mark. I don't know if you want to answer this or not. Then I'll throw it over to Deuce. All right. But this is going to be, like, you know, I think it's a pretty good one. I want you to rank the priority of these four players, and which one would you definitely keep, which one would you eliminate, right? So obviously decisions have to be made, right? So of the four, rank them 1 through 4, Cam Curl, Daron Payne, Montez Sweat, Chase Young. Who are you going to keep and who are you going to get rid of out of that group?
Well, I think the player that can become the best at their position out of those four,
as a beast goes,
I think is still Chase Young. And that's going to be a controversial opinion among Washington fans, I'm sure, because the injury and people think he's overrated. And to an extent, he is. But the talent level is still there. The potential is still there. It is unfulfilled at this point. I accept that. But I would still be keeping Chase Young around because I don't think we've even scratched the surface on how good he can be. And if he gets anywhere close to how good he can be, he's one of the top defensive ends in the league for a long time. So I would keep Chase Young around. I would keep Cam Curl around because I don't think his talent level is as high as what Chase Young's can be, but his floor is a lot higher. And he, as I kind of mentioned, I think he can reach that kind of upper echelon of safeties because of the versatility that he has, the amount of things he can do, the amount of spots that he can fill in. And, you know, the reason they've had no linebacker depth is because Cam Curl's been able to come in and basically play That's linebacker. True. And they have no slot corner because Cam Curl's been able to kick outside into the slot. So I would keep Cam Curl kind of second, I guess. And then Daron Payne and Montez Sweat is a difficult one. Montez Sweat is kind of a rarer body type, and you don't get those kind of guys on at the edge very often. I think he's a little overrated in terms of his pass rush ability. I think he's developed better than I thought he was going to, and I think he still has room to grow in that regard. But I don't know if he'll ever become that elite, you know, 15 sack a season kind of guy, and that's fine. He doesn't have to become that guy to be a good football player. But I kind of value what Daron Payne brings on the interior, maybe just a little bit more. I think Daron Payne's a better overall player than what Montez Sweat is. I think if Montez Sweat was the same level as Daron Payne, you would keep him
the edge.
On the edge because the edge is more of a valuable position than the interior.
Yeah.
But I think Daron Payne is just a better player. So I would probably just about give the edge to Payne, and then Sweat just on would be, I guess, the eliminate, but or you get rid of if you have to. But I don't necessarily think they have to get rid of any one of those. I think they can find a way around that if they wanted to.
So I'm going to let Deuce ask a question, but I want to give a shout out to my guy, East Coast Gridiron. Definitely a great content creator. Go follow him as well. He's an Eagles fan, so keep that in the context of what all these comments over here. He says, you keep Chase, you get rid of Cam Curl. Okay, I can see that potentially. I like Cam Curl. I kind of like where you're at, Mark, with the versatility of Cam Curl, so I like that as well. And then what he says, East Coast is actually a pretty good draft scout as well. He said, all the good D-line guys in the draft will be gone the first two rounds of the draft. So if you get rid of Payne, you might want to trade up on the draft. One thing I do want to say, though, is we do have Mathis that's kind of in the mix with Phil Mathis. We drafted him in the second round. We got John Ridgeway from the Cowboys. So there is some depth there. So potentially you can make your argument for letting Payne walk. But we'll see. I do like the upside. I do like the – you know, I like – having your players develop and reward them for their production. So I don't mind keeping Daron Payne in regard to that. Deuce, you have a question before we get into the draft?
So Cam Curl, right? Like I love Cam Curl. And obviously he wasn't there in the beginning of the year. You see how dreadful the defense looked. He came back, things started clicking. Then he got hurt again. And then ultimately you see how important he is to the front seven and to the back four. And even to Derek Forrest, he had like his worst games, like the next three, four games that Curl was out, he kind of had his worst stretch of games, you know, the whole year because Curl is not there. So Mark, is it because I think it's because Cam Curl is that good, but is it because our defense and our depth was so bad, especially at the linebacker position?
I think it's both of that. Curl, as I said, filled in a lot of different spots. And the reason they got by so far in the season with basically no slot corner and basically just two linebackers was because Cam Curl could fill those different roles so effectively and still play strong safety and still play deep and come into the box when they wanted to play single high and that kind of thing. And you know, the other guys in the secondary helped out with that. As you said, Derek Forrest had a decent overall season, but you're right. His play did drop off towards the end when Curl got hurt. So I think it is a combination of those, but I think Cam Curl's ability, because he's so versatile and can fill so many roles to at least a good level, if not a very high level in certain spots, I think that makes him a real essential part of this defense, especially the style of defense that they want to play with the kind of pattern matching stuff that they do. He's so smart with his play that he just kind of links the defense. He helps those secondary guys get in the right spot and he helps the front seven guys get in the right spot. And he kind of weaves it all together nicely. He's a kind of like the, he's almost like the play action game that they were missing on offense, essentially. Yeah. The front's good. The passing game was okay, but Cam Curl meshed it all together. Whereas on offense, they had the passing game was a thing and the run game was a thing, but they didn't get it to mesh. They didn't have their Cam Curl on offense to mesh that all together. So, that's kind of how I view him.
All right, last question. We'll start bringing it on home. It's from East Coast. We're on one more time, one more comment. He says, if you guys get rid of Chase, go with Keon White at Georgia Tech. He's incredible. I think we still got Chase Young for one more year, so we're not really worried about that right now. But, you know, definitely keep an eye out for it. I think they're going to sign Chase Young long-term. I think he's kind of the face of the franchise. The argument's going to be how much is he going to cost. He really has to take that next step in order to get that big contract there. So speaking of the draft, this will be our last question of the day. Mark, you know, me and Deuce talk about it all the time offline about what direction to go in the first round. Are you heart set on having offensive linemen go in the first round, or do you prefer a cornerback? Would you take a quarterback if they slip? Like, what direction would you like to go in the first round, even the second or third, if you want to go that route?
Yeah, well, I can't speak to specific players at this point because haven't done any draft work at all. We don't really get college football in the UK, so I have to get a friend.
I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah, there's like maybe one game a week shown, and that's kind of it. And so you don't really get it over here very often. So I kind of have to wait till this time of year when I hit up a friend and he gives me the access to all 22 of the college stuff, and then I can catch up. But in terms of just kind of a general thought process, I think obviously free agency is going to play into it, and the offensive coordinator is going to play into it. And if they're convincing a guy that they're going to do this run first approach and we're going to go with a zone scheme, then then maybe you think, well, Sam Cosmi's a nice zone blocker, but he's kind of struggling at right tackle. We'll slide him into guard. So we need a new right tackle. And maybe tackle is kind of maybe a higher priority for you. Or maybe you go, well, we need a new right tackle. And we kind of like Caleb McGarry from Atlanta, who is a free agent. He's developed into a decent right tackle. They run the zone scheme. So he had good familiarity with with that kind of system. Maybe you bring him in and then you don't need the tackle so much. Maybe you're looking more possibly there's a center that you like in the first round, or maybe then you start looking, well, maybe we can go corner, or maybe they go if there's a tight end. And I know this is a controversial take at the moment, based on my mentions on Twitter, but if there's a tight end that can do it all, and I don't know if there is, I don't know this class yet, but if there is a tight end that they think can be a
blocker
and, kind of guy, they can line up in line and block a defensive end on his own scheme that can kind of split outside or split into the slot or play the kind of X receiver position if you do a 3-by-1 with a tight end on one side. That adds a ton of value to an offense, to have a guy that can be that versatile and can do that much. And that could be the kind of what that Cam Curl kind of guy that meshes the passing game and run game together.
Yeah.
Then I would take that guy in the first round if you think you can find that guy. And as I say, I have no idea if that guy's there, but if that guy is there, that would be pretty high on my list of a guy that I would look to take in the first
round. I think the guy there is Mayer from Notre Dame, I believe, right? He's supposed to be like a stud. He's supposed to be able to blocker and like had like over 100 targets as well. So I think he would be a pretty solid option over there. I can definitely see that. Okay.
So I'd be open to a tight end. I'd certainly be open to corner. The system doesn't necessarily require a top corner. It doesn't necessarily require the kind of first round corners typically tend to be those big long corners that can lock down a guy in man coverage. And this guy doesn't typically, this system doesn't require you to play a ton of man coverage. It's match coverage. So that's why a guy like Kendall Fuller excels, because he sits off the line of scrimmage. He can read route combinations and knows how to match his coverage to certain routes at the right time. So you kind of need that smarts, and you can find that sometimes a little from guys that aren't necessarily quite as good in man coverage or aren't necessarily as athletic as other guys. You can usually find that in the second or third round. So I don't think corner is necessarily the need in the first round, but if there's a guy that obviously has all of that intelligence and ability while also being a great athlete and can play man coverage and what have you, then you can take that guy as well. So I think corner certainly is on that list. They need to find some corner. I think they need at least, I would want one corner that is capable of challenging Fuller and St. Juste as a starter. And then
I agree.
And then you have a little bit more depth. So that the corner certainly high on the list. I just don't necessarily think in terms of the scheme that they run, that is you definitely have to go get a first round corner. You can find those guys in the later rounds, but corner, kind of offensive line and tight end, that would be the three kind of positions, and obviously offensive line covers a couple of different spots, but that would be the three main spots that I'd be looking at.
So real quick, my guy East Coast said Michael Mayer is good. I think if you guys want one, Payne Durham from Purdue is great at both sides of blocking and catching. If you guys want a true playmaker, Dalton Kincaid from Utah is also another tight end to look at as well. So that's awesome. Thank you, East Coast. I appreciate it. Deuce, I'm done with questions. You have any one last one, or are you good to go?
Yeah, one last one. So once you do your draft profiles, please do Joey PJ Sandwich first. Joey Porter, Penn State. That's my guy. That's who I'm going with in the first round. I've been on him for a few weeks. And I know the cornerback class is very deep. I do know that. Some boards, some guys have him ranked 1-2. Some have him ranked like 4-5. I think the top five corners, they're all kind of meshed together. I don't even think the combine and pro days is going to separate those guys too much. So, I mean, any one of those guys that's there at 16, I would love to pick up. But so please do Joey Porter first, Mark, if you can.
But taking requests.
Yeah. Trust me, I use a lot of your stuff. I use a lot of your stuff to talk trash in spaces. Like I quote tweet and I tag you in the handle and stuff like that, and trying to get people to subscribe to your Substack. But what my actual question is how do you think, like, when it comes to slot corner, do you think that's something that this defense needs? Because I don't think Bobby McCain is as bad as some people say he is, but I would like someone to compete for that spot, and someone that's actually been doing it at a high level.
Yeah, it's I agree with you first and foremost that Bobby McCain isn't as bad as fans think he is, and actually he did a real nice job this year kind of adjusting his role. He started the year as a deep safety and kind of transitioned into that slot corner as Derek Forrest kind of came along nicely. So I think he certainly has a role to play on this defense. And that slot corner spot is kind of an odd one because, as I say, the defense is a pattern matching kind of thing. So you don't necessarily need that traditional slot corner that can match up with a receiver and play and jam him at the line of scrimmage and be able to force him to stop going one way or the other. The slots guys are going to do similar to what the outside guys are going to do, where they're going to stay off the line of scrimmage and they're going to read the route, the releases of not just the guy in front of them, but the other receivers nearby. And then they're going to match their coverage to the correct route. So it requires a different kind of skill set. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't go and find that kind of skill set and find a slot corner that excels there. And I absolutely agree that they should be looking to add someone, because it's not, you don't necessarily do the pattern matching stuff every single play, and you don't play zone every single play, and you don't play man every single play. You need to have the ability to flip between them. And sometimes it's third and short and you know that they're going to try to run some kind of pick play, and you need a guy that you can trust to match up in man coverage. And I don't necessarily think Bobby McCain's that guy, and that's fine. That's not his game, and it never has been. It shouldn't be. So asking him to do that would be tough. And that's why they need to find another guy that they think could do that. So yeah, definitely find a slot corner. Slot corners tend to be a little bit undervalued, and
yeah,
certainly with this system, I think that's kind of a maybe day two, day three kind of thing in the draft, yeah, or kind of a low tier free agent kind of guy.
Gotcha. Deuce, we got a question for you. Do you have a lot of energy behind this one at all?
Yeah, I think.
How do you feel about Ringo? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think Ringo fell. I think was that game against Georgia, I believe. I think it was against Georgia. Like he got beat pretty bad. Like he was really getting beat. I think he fell down some boards. But one thing that's going to happen at the combine is a lot of those guys are going to stop posting videos. So if you ever notice, he was falling down a lot of boards until he posted a video last weekend about him running that 4.3, you know. So all of a sudden after that, he started climbing back up on boards. But ultimately, I think Ringo may be the only one that falls out of the top four or five guys that we kind of look at that might be there at the top of the second round.
Dude, get top of second round. Look, that'd be interesting. Ringo definitely, you know, playing that Georgia defense, I think he actually was, you know, kind of renowned for being pretty strong altogether. But we'll see how it goes. I mean, I haven't deep dived into them yet, but he seemed like a pretty tough and pretty stout man cover corner. So we'll see how that goes. Mm-hmm. All right. So, gentlemen, I really appreciate you guys coming on and sharing your insight. What we'll do right now is I want you guys to plug your socials. Where can they find you? What products you're working on? We'll start off with Mark. Where are you at, bro?
So on Twitter, I'm at Mark Bullock NFL, and my Substack that you guys have mentioned is Bullock's Film Room, and markbullock.substack.com. And you can subscribe there and you get weekly breakdowns of whatever's going on with the Commanders, whether it's in the season and it's someone's busted a coverage, I'll break down what's happened. If it's new offensive coordinator, I'll eventually break down who that is and what their system's going to be, and then look at the kind of off-season plan of, you know, what free agents might appeal to that kind of coordinator and that system, and then eventually get onto the draft guys and break down some draft prospects. So that's kind of my plan for the offseason.
Yeah, I definitely want to plug that as well. Mark Bullock has some great content. He had Washington Post. He's one of my favorite breakdowns because he teaches that at a base level, right? As an educator, I appreciate it. He very simplifies things and puts diagrams on there, makes it easy to digest. So it's a very good, high-quality content. So definitely look into his work, and thank you, Mark, for coming on. I appreciate that. Deuce, Where are you at on socials? Or what are you working on, bro?
Yeah, I'm just going to double up on Mark, like on his Substack. Like, please, man, it's great content. He posts, he got some stuff in the behind the scenes that some people on Twitter don't see. He does a Q&A and he's starting back up on Fridays, I believe. So you just ask questions and he can't kind of answer them. But follow Mark, subscribe to that Substack, because I definitely use it to talk trash.
everyone's being kind. So I'm gonna prop up Deuce. Deuce is one of the most authentic people on Twitter. Definitely follow him at Red Zone in the Lab. He has his own podcast, Owning the Huddle. He also is a Spaces King. He's always on the space. If you go on a Commander Space any given day, he'll be on there for sure. And guys, I'm George Carmi. No problem, man. I'm George Carmi from Full Press Commanders. This is the Command the Pike podcast. Definitely subscribe on YouTube. I want it to grow a little bit. I appreciate that. Follow me on Twitter at GCarmi21. Have a great day, y'all. Peace out.